Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 778 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and we'll be talking about three Aftershock titles that are hitting stands this coming Wednesday. But first, a quick reminder about WonderCon. Hey, everyone. With WonderCon coming up in Anaheim, California on March 29th, 30th, and 31st, we wanted to let you know that the Comic Source will be there, bringing you live coverage of the convention with photos, live tweetings of panels, creator interviews, cosplay, and a whole lot more. Also, we'll be having giveaways throughout the weekend for fans attending the convention. We'll have tons of lanyards to give away, as well as one lucky fan each day can win an iPad full of comics. So to celebrate Batman's 80th anniversary, we filled several iPads full of great Batman stories, along with a few other of our favorites like Harbinger from Valiant, Clone from Robert Kirkman's Skybound Image imprint, the first 21 issues of Ultimate Spider-Man, and some of our favorite Superman stories. So how do you win? Well, you need to be sure you're following us on social media so you can find Jace, me, on the show floor or in a panel room. And since this is all about Batman, if you can name five of the Batman story arcs that we put on the iPad before missing three, the iPad is yours. We'll have at least one iPad to give away each day of the show, Friday through Sunday. So be sure to brush up on the best Batman story arcs of all time, because it's three strikes and you're out. Also be sure you're following us on Twitter and Instagram all weekend to join in the fun and win some awesome swag. Hope to see you all there. All right, I'm really excited about the giveaways we have. I can't wait to hook some people up with some iPads full of some great comics. So again, be sure you're following us on social media, because we're going to be giving out clues. Putting pictures up constantly of where I am on the show floor and what panels I'm attending. So again, if you want a chance to win one of those iPads, be sure to check us out on Twitter and Instagram. All right, let's go ahead and get started with the books I'm going to talk about today. The first one is Beyonders number 5 from writer Paul Jenkins. We have Wesley St. Clair handling the art and Marshall Dillon on the letters. So the Beyonders title, if you're not familiar, it postulates the theory that what if all those crazy conspiracy theories, historical conspiracies that everybody thinks are real, crop circles and you know, secret society, Illuminati, Leonardo da Vinci, you know, Benjamin Franklin, all part of the, you know, Masons and these secret societies that rule the world. This series from Paul Jenkins postulates that all that's true, right? All of it's true. Ancient computer systems and just all kinds of crazy, crazy stuff. So far, what we've seen is the young boy that we meet in the first issue, Jake, has been recruited by Noreen into another one of those secret societies. And this secret society, this group is called the Beyonders, and is supposedly dedicated to keeping the world safe, finding the secrets. We're led to believe early on that they're the good guys, right? And they go up against the Order, who apparently are a somewhat similar, if slightly distorted, mirror image sort of secret society that are dedicated to keeping their power base and the power that exists in the world of the hands of the very few. We don't know that much about the history of either of these groups. What exactly is it that makes the Order malevolent and the Beyonders good, supposedly? And why hasn't anyone been able to crack these codes over the thousands of years that the Beyonders have existed? All of a sudden, this young boy gets recruited, as I mentioned, and I don't know, he's like a genius-level code cracker. He's like the prophesied one, the one they've been waiting for all along, the one who's destined to uncover the secrets behind all these conspiracy theories. But the one thing I'm not quite sure about is, like, a lot of these conspiracy theories and the things that were going on seem to be perpetrated by past Beyonders. So it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. Like, wouldn't they leave clues or, you know, like a code book? Like, yeah, I I discovered something, and I created this worldwide mystery instead of just passing down the information to the next generation of Beyonders. Like, it doesn't make complete sense, and I'm not quite sure what exactly the order is trying to allow to happen. The whole thing is just a little confusing in a way, and it might just be because we don't have the whole story yet. Maybe once the whole story unravels, then, you know, we'll have an idea. But it goes back to any real story like this, and you know, it's not a completely original concept. When you have a movie, I mean, you think of something like National Treasure, right, where there's all these conspiracies and secret kind of stuff that people didn't know about, and then they sort of discover it. But you end up finding yourself asking, so why now? Like, why is all of this being unlocked now? Why is the end of the world coming now? It, as I said, almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, but Noreen and Jake are trying to stop it. And why you'd send out your two of your kind of junior people isn't 100% clear to me either. But they certainly aren't all-knowing, all-seeing, super wise, because we saw in the third issue that they're actually responsible for setting off a chain of events that's supposedly going to cause the end of the world. And we saw issue four, they kind of, I mean, obviously they felt bad, and they're trying to figure out a way to save it, right? But again, you got to wonder, so what's this order doing, right? I mean, they're looking to preserve the world as well, but they just want to make sure it's preserved in the way they want it. But now this conspiracy, like some of the clues they're searching for, they've inadvertently set off this chain reaction that's supposed to end the world. But now if they keep going down the path, like, again, it just gets convoluted. And you end up wondering, okay, why is it these two kids, Jake and Noreen, that are responsible for saving the world when there's this huge Beyonders organization? And, you know, Jenkins does a good job of giving us an in story reason, you know, oh, they suspect there's a mole within the Beyonders, so they end up out on their own, and they don't have anybody they can trust. I mean, again, it's not the most original way to tell a story, but for all the confusion, for all the little things you can nitpick, it is a really fun story, and I do appreciate that by the time we get to issue four, it is Noreen and Jake on their own, because then they're kind of left to their own devices in terms of they don't have any backup, and it gives the story a little more consequence, and it gives it more of an adventure feel because these two are out on their own, as opposed to having this, you know, organization with all these resources and everything behind them. So I do enjoy the story. I don't want to make it sound like I'm nitpicking on it too much. Maybe it's just frustration on my part because I haven't been able to figure out what's going on yet. But I really do enjoy the story. And not only is Paul Jenkins a great writer that tells a great story and gives these characters their little quirks and foibles that make them feel more real and more fleshed out and more relatable, it's also the fact that he gives them great dialogue too. And their voices in terms of their dialogue are very distinctive, but yet consistent throughout the title so far. Also, I want to mention that there are clues. There's a secret code within this book. I haven't worked really hard on trying to figure it out. I have at times glanced through the book, and in each and every panel of the book, you'll see a little symbol. And what those symbols mean, I have no idea. But apparently if you can solve it, you're going to win some kind of incredible prize from Aftershock, which I think is just really cool. And, I haven't really gotten online and done much research to see if anybody's kind of coming close to figuring it out or has any sort of ideas whatsoever. I mean, I have no clue. My first thought would be, well, copy all the symbols down and maybe, I haven't even noticed any symbols repeating, which you kind of got to think they must repeat, right? Like if these symbols are standing in for like letters in our alphabet, that would make sense. Like, is it a sentence in each in each book that then gives like a paragraph that's a clue, or is it one long sentence? Like, I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. But at some point, I really do need to spend a little time trying to figure it out. So, really cool idea from Aftershock and Paul Jenkins to put these clues in there for people that love puzzles and to break codes and all that kind of stuff. So I really do recommend that you check out Beyonders if you haven't had a chance to yet. All right. One of the other books that's coming out from Aftershock is Lollipop Kids number 4. This is from writers Adam and Aiden Glass. We also have Diego Yapur on art. And DC Alonso handling the colors with Sal Cipriano on letters. So if you're not familiar with this book, it's based on the idea that when the pilgrims came over to the New World, not only did they bring the good, they also brought the bad. Part of the reason they were allowed to leave Europe is because they took a lot of the monsters with them. And when they got to the New World, they built a prison and locked those monsters up. And that prison now exists in what we know as Central Park in New York. So Adam and Aiden Glass, father and son writing team here, they built this story out of some of the bedtime stories they used to make up. And Adam and Aiden and Adam's daughter, Aiden's sister, and their mom, they used to kind of tell these stories of these lollipop kids when... they were bedtime stories when they were going to bed at night. So Adam and Aiden got together and adapted one of these stories and fleshed it out. And this is the story that they're telling. This the story of these monsters that came over from the New World and how, as I mentioned, prison built in Central Park. But now the monsters are in danger of breaking free. So for whatever reason, it hasn't been explained yet, or if it has, I've forgotten, but the people that are in charge of guarding this park or putting the monsters back when they break out, which they do periodically, are kids, lollipop kids. And apparently once you reach a certain age, you can no longer be a lollipop kid and you don't even have memories that this used to happen, that you used to be part of this, the secret guild to protect the world from the monsters in the park. So in the first issue, we meet Nick, and his sister Mia has gone missing, and he's looking for her. And as he's in Central Park late at night, he discovers his heritage of being a lollipop kid. And then there's something that happens at the end of issue 3 that's a little bit surprising. It's a little bit of a twist. I don't want to give it away, even though it happened, last issue. But it is important enough to the story that if you're going to pick this up, I want you to be able to discover it for yourself. So that kind of changes the tone and complexity of the series, what we learn about at the end of issue 3. And issue 4 continues that, and the action really ramps up in this issue 4 that's coming out this Wednesday. So it's action from start to finish. And we see a couple of the parts of the legend of King Arthur, Camelot, show up here. We get Morgan Le Fay. We get a mention of Excalibur. So you wonder how many other myths and legends of the past Adam and Aiden are going to weave into the story. And it's really cool to see them weave aspects of other legends, into the story. At the end, we get a glimpse, a full-page illustration from Diego Yapur, the artist who does absolutely incredible work, that really shows what these lollipop kids are up against, so to speak. And again, it's bringing classic elements of other legends and stories into this this lollipop kid story. I mean, we it looks like we have the mummy, Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Frankenstein, Medusa. It's really, really cool that this army of monsters are recognizable, right? some recognizable from Universal Studios movies, but again, it's really cool. So it started out as a bit of a mystery with Nick searching for his sister, and now it's kind of morphed into this action-adventure story starring these young kids, which there's been a few titles like that recently, action-adventure starring young kids. Another title from Aftershock actually comes to mind, and that would be from Zach Kaplan, his Lost City Explorer series. So I always enjoy those tales. I think it's important to have stories that star younger protagonists. It helps to make it relevant for younger readers. And you know, I talk all the time about how we really need to bring the next generation of comic readers in. And when you tell stories where kids can see themselves as these heroes, you know, this isn't Batman or Superman. You know, they don't have crazy superpowers. They're not, you know, out there running, you know, as fast as the Flash or flying through space like Green Lantern. So it's, in a way, it's much easier for kids to relate to these protagonists. And the other the cool thing, when we talked to Adam and Aiden on the podcast about this when the series was first about to come out, is the fact that Nick has dyslexia. And, you know, he sees the world in a different way, and it actually helps him in terms of looking for his sister and eventually finding the Lollipop Kids and discovering his heritage because he sees things in a different way. And so, again, it's great to have stories starring characters that have things that kids can relate to. You know, I think Aiden himself has a touch of dyslexia, and it's just cool, right? It doesn't mean you're dumb. You know, that was a stereotype and a stigma that stuck with dyslexia for a long time, and thank God it's pretty much gone away at this point. I don't hear it too often anymore, but you know, an assumption people used to make, kids that had dyslexia, you know, they couldn't read, and so they couldn't learn to read, struggled, and people, oh, this kid's too dumb to read. It's not that. It just has to do with the way your brain processes information, the way you see, you know, letters on the page. It just doesn't make sense to you. And so, again, the fact that this title stars a kid with dyslexia, this, you know, challenging learning, I don't know if you call it a disability, but this, you know, the challenge to the way they learn, again, something relatable. There's a lot of kids out there with dyslexia that probably never would have ever dreamed that they'd have a comic book protagonist that they could relate to that had the same affliction that they have. So again, I think it's really cool. And I've talked before about the art by Diego Yapur, which I hope Aftershock gets to do at least a few projects with this guy before he's snatched up by a bigger publisher, because his art is absolutely spectacular. He does a great job with the monsters. He does a great job making these protagonists look like kids. Because that's the thing. It's like so many artists, they can draw kids in terms of scale. They just take an adult and draw them smaller. But that's not really what kids look like, right? I mean, their faces tend to be a little more round, a little more cherubic. And it's important to differentiate. You know, you don't just take an adult face and shrink it down and make that a kid. It's, you know, there are changes that we all go through when we grow up, when we go from being a kid to being an adult. And Diego does a great job of keeping these characters looking like kids instead of just miniature adults. Plus his details, his sense of acting, the backgrounds, the monsters. I think I mentioned that already. Does an incredible job with the monsters. It's really a beautiful book to look at. So again, I hope that Aftershock can keep him on for at least a few titles before he inevitably gets stolen away. I mean, I can't believe this guy's not already a superstar. That's how great his art is. And also the color work. This story mostly takes place at night, or it has to this point. So I've got to shout out the color work of DC Alonso. It's not always easy to keep things clear. You know, when you're doing stories that happen at night, you're going to be using, you know, a darker palette, a lot of blues, a lot of purples, maybe some browns and blacks, and it can make the art start to seem muddy, if you know what I mean. And I think that DC does a great job of not falling into that trap, so I have to give him a shout-out as well. The other title from Aftershock that comes out today, I'm not really going to talk about it too much in detail because I did cover it on when I did a preview episode not too long ago, talking about a bunch of the titles that were coming up, like Dark Red and Replacer and I think Horde. But the title that I'm specifically talking about is Out of the Blue, the hardcover from Garth Ennis and art by Keith Burns. It's basically those two creators reuniting. They'd previously worked together on Johnny Red, which was also a World War II story, just like Out of the Blue is. Also dealt with aerial combat. And, you know, I'm a big sucker for World War II stories, especially ones that have to do with pilots and flying. I love those kind of stories. I love the skill with which it took to fly those planes, and the courage. And, you know, I try not to romanticize the World War II era because it was a very brutal time, and we kind of look back on it with rose-colored glasses, and because we won, basically, and the Allies, that is, and we look back on it, and we have a sense of pride and a sense of achievement, and I think that's where a lot of the warm feelings come from. But you also have to remember that, you know, thousands and thousands of people died on both sides. And then when you add in the number of people who died in the Holocaust, the extermination of the Jews by the Nazis, you know, the number climbs into the millions. So I think I just want to remind everybody, we have to be careful about romanticizing it too much. That's not to say that it's not a period of time that did have a lot of heroism, and there were a lot of people who sacrificed and rose up and answered the call. And so I think for the most part, the stories do a good job of celebrating that aspect of it. And that's certainly how I feel about the first volume of Out of the Blue. As I was reading it, I was kind of surprised because it's a story of this pilot who gets on the bad side of his commander. He's a Royal Air Force pilot, so British, and he gets on the bad side of his commanding officer, like right off the bat from his first day at this new post. And so he's kind of struggling to make amends, but the guy really doesn't want to hear it. He's really not a very good officer. And not only does he have an in for this new pilot, he also has designs on the guy's wife. And so as I was reading it, Ennis really takes his time establishing the story and giving us an idea of who these people are. The rest of the cast, the supporting cast, are fleshed out relatively quickly. It's a real skill that Ennis has, just with, you know, a little bit of dialogue here or there, casual sentence here or there, that gives us all of a sudden a fully realized supporting character. So he spends a little time setting that up. We get a little bit of the backstory of the commanding officer and the pilot and his friends, and it gives us good context for the story. But, before I knew it, I was like 20 pages in, and I'm like, okay, there's no way this gets resolved in this issue. And I didn't know it was going to be multiple volumes. This Out of the Blue is going to be multiple volumes. But that's exactly what it's going to be, because the first volume here, where we just are getting started. I feel like we're just picking up the pace, and I have a feeling volume two is going to be paced much quicker, and we'll see a lot more aerial combat missions. I mean, we saw a couple here, but I imagine we're going to see a lot more in volume two. And Keith Burns does a great job of expertly illustrating the dog fighting and the air combat, the warfare. It's done really, really well, whether it's planes battling planes or planes attacking ships in the water. Again, it all feels very real, very visceral, and it's great to see these old World War II planes in action, you know, even if it is just illustrations in a comic. So I very much encourage you to pick it up. When it comes to writing war stories, there is absolutely nobody working in comics today. Nobody. There is no other writer working in comics today that handles this genre better than Garth Ennis, without question. So definitely think about picking up that that hardcover today, Out of the Blue, it's called. And the other thing I'll mention about Aftershock's hardcovers is what high quality they are. Like, I mean, you just pick it up. Like, if you see one in your shop and you go in there, you just pick the hardcover up. It feels solid. It feels like quality. You know, it's a really thick cover. The bindings are done really, really well. This isn't a hardcover that's going to, you know, fall apart on you or really show a lot of wear and tear if you read it a few times. So I love that about Aftershock. Their hardcovers, their regular comics have high production values too, but their hardcovers are especially cool. So definitely check those out. All right, I think that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. I want to thank you all for joining me as always. Don't forget about Manny and I being at WonderCon in Anaheim, California this coming weekend. Hope to see you all there.